Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Short and hot with Chef Family. Short and hot with Chef Family.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 86. We are up to 86. My producer, Anne, with me in the studio. How are you, Anne?
Hey, how's it going?
I made my own sourdough starter.
I saw that.
I'm so proud of myself. We had Stephen Yaffa on, and I did an interview with him. He wrote a new book called Grain of Truth.
Right.
We've gotten a lot of feedback. Universally, what's made it to me is universally either positive or exhausted.
Okay.
So a very good friend of mine sent me, she messaged me a picture of a bag of bread that's readily accessible in the supermarket. And what we learned from Stephen Yaffa is that if you can buy a bag of bread in the supermarket, it's probably not up to the standards that Grain of Truth is kind of promoting that people eat. And it's all marketing, essentially.
Okay. And like that goes for, you know, something like a, I don't know, like a bread alone or something that like...
I can't call them out individually because I don't know. And that's why I don't want to say the brand that she... But she was like, even this? And I was like, I think, yeah.
I mean, I feel like anything to, you know, I don't know, survive in a supermarket shelf for anything longer than... You know, a day and
I'll
still
tell you.
Tastes wonderful. It probably has some additives or something.
It's got to have additives, and it's soft sandwich bread, which is what she's looking for.
Oh, you can't get soft sandwich bread.
It's got to have a crust. There's like this trade-off because we've been sort of trained to expect that bread should be light and fluffy and powdery.
Right.
And it can be that, but it cannot also be like hyper good for you in a way. So this interview is available if you go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the opinion tab. You can hear the whole extended. Go ahead. I can tell you there's passion here. There's passion. Go for
it. Well, I was interested in what, like, why the reason is he saying that? Is it because of the whole grain? And is that why, like, if you make any, like, softer bread, it's because it's stripped of its bran or endosperm? Or is it other reasons, like, is he putting out there?
Initially, yes. And then also the process of fermentation, which originally, you know, which is what bread originally went through, which is what why I embarked on my sourdough mission, is that the fermentation actually does some of the digesting for you. Okay. And so he talks a lot about the statistics of people who are gluten sensitive or feel the effects of gluten in some way.
Right.
I'm not going to give away the punchlines here, but holy crap, was it eye-opening.
Wow.
I was like, I knew it.
Okay. I love when you whisper on it. That's my favorite.
So he's very, very passionate and he's very good. The book is very, very, it's very well written. It's very readable and funny and it's not like bossy or, it's very pragmatic.
Okay.
Like dogmatic was the word I was looking for. So essentially the process of fermenting your own wheat at home, he challenged me to do because I confessed on air that our house bread is Martin's potato bread. And he was like, and so now after having this interview and reading the book, I realized like I can eat my Martin's potato bread, but I'm going to tell myself it's a slice of angel food cake.
Okay.
So it's not the worst thing I could eat. It's, you know, but it ain't healthy. I
mean, right.
And so I have to stop making my kid sandwiches on Martin's potato bread and think I'm giving him some good fuel for his brain and his growing body because it's just not that. And so about 10 days ago, right when we finished the interview, I went home because I had some New York State ancient grain. They're doing this wonderful revitalization of ancient grains that had been grown in New York State.
Okay.
My husband and I had bought some at the farmer's market. And it's like, you literally just put some grain and some water and you stir it. And then I covered it with plastic wrap and let it go to work. So, no,
amazing.
I didn't use plastic wrap. I used an inverted plastic bag, like a bag that I brought home groceries in.
Okay.
Because I was looking at the images that are on King Arthur's website. And so I was like, I was the student. I was like, okay, 4 ounces of this. And I weighed it out and four ounces of water. And so the next morning, I took the plastic off to see what had happened, and what had happened was that the ants found it.
And
it was like the La Brea tar pits with these fans like trying to get away. So I scrapped that, and I started fresh, and I used cheesecloth with a really big elastic band that I have, and that kept the ants out. And every day, you open it up, and it's like a little biome in there. You throw half of it away. You cut it in half. You know, you weigh out 4 ounces. You throw the rest away.
Okay.
Now, you can keep the what you throw away and use it for other stuff, but turns out if you don't throw it away, you end up with so much sourdough starter.
It's just like taking over your entire kitchen.
And you know who loves it are my chickens. They now see that come and they're like, yes, sweet carbohydrates. So I fed it and watered it and fed it and watered it. And then on Monday, I made my first sourdough bread.
Yay.
I was so excited.
Was it delicious?
It was delicious. It was really good. I used the King Arthur flour, like, your first sourdough. Like, you're going to be fine. And I will say that my dough in the mixing process was much stiffer and denser than theirs looked in the picture. So I thought I might end up with something rather brick-like.
Right.
But there's an addition of yeast. So it's not all risen on the exhalation of your sourdough. You add extra yeast to it, and that kind of foolproofs it a little bit.
Okay.
It's delicious. Like, it's so cool to be like, I know exactly what product's in there. I know exactly where everything came from. And it's the yeast from my house. You know, it's like floating around in my environment.
Right, right. That is, that's something very satisfying about making your own bread. Like, it feels very, I don't know.
And
like,
more so
than other things. It just feels like hearty and like.
And I will say it's very soft. It's very fluffy. It's got a crust on it, which is a good thing.
Right.
It's not soft all the way around like my Martin's potato bread. But I used all all-purpose flour, with the exception of what was in the starter, which at this point is very low proportion to the rest of the flour that I used.
Okay.
But now I can kind of start playing around with it. Like, I'll add a little bit here of some rye flour or pumpernickel or whatever, and I have my starter percolating away in the refrigerator. And
the starter never, like, you always have to keep part of the starter, right? Is that right?
Yeah, you measure off what you're going to use in your recipe, and then you feed what's left over. So I've learned that,
love that
bread people are like a whole, they're like cheese people or beer people. Like, they're a whole group of people. And I'm just like dipping my toe into this universe, and it's like, holy crap, there's a lot to know. But people name their starter to humanize it so you don't forget about it in your refrigerator.
Yeah, I would definitely do that.
So I haven't landed on it. Nothing is like.
He hasn't told you yet.
He hasn't told me yet, but I will say, like, you know that.
Is it gendered? Is it a boy?
See, until you said that, I thought it was a woman, but maybe that's why I haven't come up with a name, is that what it hasn't told me is that it's actually a man.
All right.
Well, but here's the other thing. I have a dog named Rooster and a cat named Oyster, so it should be like sourdough
named Soap.
Yeah. And here we have it. And here
Ladies
we have
and gentlemen,
it. We'll name
live
it
on air. We will name you Soap, and we will love you and feed you forever.
So that would work, right? And everybody thinks it's weird, and I can't disagree, but I don't know. It's the cat's name is Oyster.
There you go.
Cool. And so I was at a meeting on Wednesday night, and we had to wrap up, and like I had a bus to catch, but I had put my phone on silent because they were very specific, like, this is a technology-free zone. We're all going to really focus on the matter at hand. And my phone rang, and what I didn't, it was my alarm, but it was the sound of a ringing phone, and I jumped out, and it was a food-based meeting. I was like, I have to feed my starter, and everybody cracked up. I was like, only in this line of work would that be acceptable and funny. Mm-hmm. So the other thing, speaking of wheat, we have some room in our schedule in June, and I think that you and I should put together a project that I've been kicking around for a while, and I'm gonna involve Jack, our executive engineer, in this conversation. Hi, Jack.
Sorry. Hey there.
Hey, I did not give you any heads up that I was going to do that. I'm sorry. It just came to me. Did you hear I was over-caffeinated?
Yes.
So we have a couple of openings in June, and I think I want to focus one of those shows on being devoted to people's questions about wheat in all of its forms. So wheat berries and farro and grinding and growing. And we'll get some experts in to answer the questions.
I think it's fantastic.
So if you're listening live, if you want to email me, chefemily@sharpandhot.com, or you can tweet me at chefemilyp, we're going to start collecting thematic questions.
That's great.
And I think the wheat one's going to be really fun because I got a lot of questions.
Maybe we can coax Dave Arnold into sticking around and guesting on the show.
Yeah, that would be great because he's got the science part. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Cool. All right. So we'll plan that, listeners, and then we're also going to do one for seafood because Sustainable Seafood Week is coming up in New York City.
Yes.
And we're going to have some fishermen and fish purveyor people on, and so we can do the same thing if people have questions, like, because buying sustainable seafood, there is not a silver bullet. There is not a black and white answer that I can say, just order flounder and you'll be fine. It just doesn't exist. So to address the nuance and complexity of the issue for people who care and are dedicated, we're going to have some experts on to help us suss that out as well.
That's
good ideas.
Cool. Good. Cool. Okay. If there are other things out there that you guys want to know about, I would love to hear them too. I'm happy to dedicate showtime if you want to know about sweeteners or cream and dairy or whatever it is. Like, I'm happy to take recommendations because
There's a lot to talk about out there.
Well, I realized, so I was in this food focused meeting the other day and I was like, I live and breathe all of this, and I wonder, like, are there things that I just don't even like see or hear anymore because I'm so immersed in the world. Deputy Director Allison Hamlin and I were talking about this while we were waiting for lunch this afternoon. Like, we pursued this line of work because we loved food and cooking, and now food and cooking is like, that's my job, and I want my hobbies to be reading about like small airplanes or whatever. Like, I don't necessarily want to pick up a food publication because that's my job, which I love. So we were just discussing this paradox of following your pleasure and your passion.
Yeah, I think it happens. But that'll be very cool to do those episodes. I think it'll be like exciting, and we can get like some real quality over quantity. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, let's write it down.
Sure. After the break, speaking of quality, we have with us, joining us in the studio, Olivia Rathbone, who has just produced a beautiful new cookbook called the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center Cookbook, Fresh from the Garden Recipes for Gatherings Large and Small. It is published by Chelsea Green. She's going to be here to talk to us about all things heritage vegetables, and I'm very excited. And lots of other stuff, too.
So, Detta Hartman on the break. We'll be right back.
Born from discord and harmonies, raised by the rays of the falling sun. Cruel that rage of our true Cupid makes life the killer of the mighty python. So a typical.
Visit a farm. Log on to escapemaker.com for more ideas on local weekend getaways and day trips, including orchards, farms, and wineries. Or come by Escape Maker's Yellow Tent in Grow NYC's Green Markets and pick up a guide to local agritourism escapes to the Green Market's own farmers and producers. The guide will be updated seasonally to feature farms, wineries, and destinations in New York City, New York State, New Jersey, Vermont, and Pennsylvania. Plus, Escape Maker will offer overnight packages to these destinations so you can get the full experience. No car? No problem. Escape Maker features plenty of ideas for car-free getaways, including discounts via Amtrak. There's no better time to explore outside the city. Soak up the fresh air and scenery like a butterfly and support your local farmer. Log on to escapemaker.com to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot, everyone. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joining us now in the studio is Olivia Rathbone, the author you call yourself. Well, let me say hi, Olivia.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Emily.
You, in the back of this book, you describe yourself as the, or someone has described you as the master cat shepherdess.
Indeed.
So I love that title. I hope you get that printed on business cards.
Yeah. That kind of describes it to a T. The Occidental Arts and Ecology Center is run as a collective, and there were over 40 contributors to this project, both recipe contributors and then just all the content in part one. And so I'm the one who kind of put it all together, but it was definitely an amazing team effort.
So tell me about the center itself.
So we're an 80-acre sustainability demonstration site located in Sonoma County, California. So we're kind of near the coast. And we teach courses in ecological design. We also have a school garden teacher training program. And we also do a lot of advocacy, sort of eco-activism, trying to make sustainability legal, because a lot of sustainable activities are actually illegal. Sure. So we're working hard both to just educate individuals and then make change happen sort of at the pace that really needs to get going in order to actually make a difference in this really... this transition that we're going through at the moment.
So be more specific. I'm pretty sure I know where you're going, because there's a very eloquent conversation about genetically engineered organisms or genetically modified organisms. And this is a topic that I've remained kind of like, I have not had the bandwidth to like fully educate myself. Mm-hmm. I know that there have been prominent scientists who have said it's not a black and white issue. From the moment we said this ear of corn, not this ear of corn, we have been driving which one we're going to produce and which one we're not. Mm-hmm. But there's a very eloquent essay about the legality issues around seed saving and what's happening when we've given our seed production over to companies that are have profits so that they're primary focus.
So. Yeah. So just to back up a little bit, one of the main goals of the garden at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center is this idea of preserving biodiversity. And biodiversity is really the backbone of resilience, of biological resilience. If you have a crop, if you're growing one variety of corn or potatoes or what have you, and you're not doing anything else that's totally devoid of other types of plants and animal and insect life, then you become very vulnerable to pests. Then if you get one pest, then your whole crop is gone. Whereas if you have a good diversity of things growing in your garden, then you have some other things to fall back on. And so I'm going to get around to the the GMO thing, I promise. But one of our favorite recipes that you'll find in the book is for the biodiversity salad mix. And this is the dish that we're really most known for because, we're in northern sort of chilly coastal California, and so greens grow abundantly all year round. And there's like a seasonal focus to our book, and we really have a strong ethos around eating seasonally, eating what's in season. And when you have a biodiverse garden, what's wonderful about picking a salad mix is, as our head gardener likes to say, the salad is a snapshot of the garden on any given day. So the spring mix, which at one point actually topped out at like 100 ingredients, wow, is very different from the fall mix or the winter mix or the summer mix. So that was a really fun thing to talk about in the book. Anyway, back to genetically modified organisms. You know, we do a fair amount of science and trial and error research at the center, but we're really committed to not using pesticides. That's really our main thing. And GMO crops are really geared towards industrial agriculture, monocropping with heavy pesticide use. And so we just can't get behind that. And whether, you know, the word is still out whether they're actually safe, and we don't have a strong of an opinion about that, but it's more about the pesticide use and also the fact that, you know, saving seed used to be something that all of our ancestors knew how to do, and that was just part of agriculture, and we've gotten so far away from that give and take relationship with our food and with nature that now just the, all of that knowledge, which has now become proprietary in the hands of corporations, mm-hmm. are not available to your average farmer across the world. And that's not good for food security for any of us. So...
It's just terrifying to think about, and how it was like promised to like, this is going to ensure food security and everyone's going to have enough food. Like, it's just not fair. You know, it's bad market. It was just like bad marketing, and people were like, oh, okay, now we're here.
Yeah. And most of the GMO crops have been designed so that they, not to be tastier, not to be more healthy, mm-hmm. or any of that. It's just they're designed to be resistant to more pesticides. So the only thing GMOs have really given us in the long run is just more pesticides in our food.
Right. And pesticide resistant super weeds and bugs.
Yeah.
Oops. So let me ask you a question about seed saving. I have knock on wood, very proud of my garden this year. This is the first year that I've had the Venn diagram of time, space, and childcare have intersected in a way that I have the ability to make a pretty decent looking garden, right? Right now it's perfect. I have some tatsoi, which bolted early. Most of the plants have not, and a couple of the plants have bolted. And for the listeners, that means that the plant goes from being short leafy greens to sending up a flower stalk, which will then flower, be pollinated, and create the seeds that'll become the plant for next season. I was like, oh, I'll let those bolt because then I'll save those seeds. Should I actually wait for like the last plant that bolts so that I'm selecting a late bolting tatsoi?
Well, that's the thing. You want to select for what you want to select for. You could select for the tastiest.
Okay.
You could select for the biggest leaves. You could select for the slowest bolting. You could select for the most vigorous and less sort of disease ridden one. So it's up to you. Tatsoi you want to make, that's what you get to create. That's
so
the exciting
if it's
part.
If it's not the tastiest or the most prolific or the best leaves, I'm really, if I harvest from those two plants, I'm selecting for early bolt. Possibly.
Yes, and okay. Whatever other traits they are carrying with
okay.
them.
Okay, so I'm going to leave those guys be because we have the beehives there and the flowers are pretty and delicious. And but I'm glad that... See, when we were booking you for the show, I was like, I have so many gardening questions. But I'm going to try not to make this all about me. We'll see. You're handshaking your head.
Well, you bring up a great point because gardening in a seed-saving garden can actually be so fun. Because, because you have this opportunity to interact with the plant and select for what you want. And then also, you know, most gardeners have been trained to rip out plants as soon as they start to bolt. But letting them go to seed gives, you know, food for the foragers, and you can put them in your salads, and it can affect your kitchen and the way that you use them as well. So it's
last great. Season, I stopped going after the dandelions. I had always been someone, like my father trained me, like, get the dandelions out of the garden. Right, and then I read that if you leave the dandelions, they actually make everything else taste better around it.
Uh-huh.
And so we did a little trial with some basil.
Huh.
I mean, it could have just been what I was looking for, but I was like, that basil definitely tastes better. Huh. And I didn't waste 2 hours or 3 hours going after something that's essentially harmless.
And you can eat it, too.
And you can eat it. So speaking of recipes, hey, Jack, we have a question from a listener queued up. You have a recipe in here for Orach Paneer Spicy Creamed Mountain Spinach. Mm-hmm. And the first ingredient, and I'm going to share this recipe on Sharp and Hot, but the first ingredient calls for 3 bunches of orach, magenta lamb's quarters, or any abundant sauté greens. So I'm going to let Jack play the listener question, but the recipes in the book refer to things that may not be accessible. Mm. Like the average home cook might be like,
what
the hell is orach?
Yeah.
So let's play the question, and then we'll talk about ingredients.
Can you use... lamb's quarters in the recipe for orach paneer. So we have a lot of lamb's quarters growing, and it would be great to have a recipe for them. Thanks.
Okay, so we have lamb's quarters, which Anne pointed out it was necessary, and I should... you say it.
Well, no, yeah, I just thought we should... Well, I felt like the recipe kind of like laid tell to it, but when they were talking about it outside, about lamb's quarters, I was like, huh, I was like, so... He's talking about like a butchering. We're gonna like a little piece of lamb. We're getting a cut. I thought she was like more green. It was interesting. And then I found out that it was indeed.
It is a plant. Lamb's quarters are a plant. Okay, so can you use lamb's quarters in place of orach? And what is orach? Because I've never heard of orach.
So in California, in the summertime, it can get really dry and really hot. And spinach, which is kind of people's go-to green, just doesn't like to grow in the summer. It's just too extreme. Lettuce, the same thing. But there are some great sauté greens that do really well in the heat, including this thing called orach, which comes in a variety of different shapes and colors. So we plant that instead when the spinach is not happy anymore.
And lamb's quarters grow like a weed at my house as well. I mean, we didn't weed them out last year thinking like, oh, we'll eat some of that. And we went out one day, it was bigger than me. I mean, it was just this enormous plant.
So much food.
Right.
And it's so good. They're really highly nutritious too. So
we are almost out of time, but I want to touch on your school garden program, uh-huh. because this is a project that I'm very, very passionate about. And one of the things that I have seen in my experience as a middle school teacher and a school, a garden advocate, and now as a culinary person, is that there's a lot of energy and a lot of money and a lot of passion into the building of a garden. And then if that teacher who is passionate leaves, or that principal needs to find a couple $1,000 to cut from a budget, the garden, I mean, I can think of two examples in the East Village off the top of my head that are just graveyards. And so you have a very unique approach to this.
Yeah. So we found through OAAC's work in community organizing, really, that nothing can be done just by one person, that really to have long-lasting results, you really need to have a team effort. So schools have to, in order to come to our school garden teacher training, they apply as a whole school and send a team that has a couple of parents and the principal and a couple teachers and just a critical mass of people that if that one person leaves, like you're talking about, then there's some longevity built in. And then also we do a lot of focus on how to tie sort of the core curriculum standards to garden-based lessons, because I think teachers just need more encouragement and more support in that area in order to keep being able to justify being out there.
I'll tell you, I tried to have a school garden in my middle school, and we planted some daffodil bulbs because it was like exhausting for, and like, I don't want to put the responsibility on the teachers because you're like, are you kidding? I'm already doing so much. So if there is that passion. So do you accept teacher or schools from all over the country?
Yes, absolutely. Go to our website, www.oaec.org.
And is there a time, like you accept applications during a certain part of the year? Or is it rolling?
I think it's rolling throughout the year,
So school teachers out there, I know you're listening. Please, please, please say it one more time. It's oaec.org. The cookbook is called the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center Cookbook, Fresh from the Garden Recipes for Gatherings, Large and Small, published by Chelsea Green. Olivia Rathbone, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Emily, thanks.
And do you know who's on next week's show?
I do. It's Jill Donenfeld, who wrote the cookbook Better on Toast.
And I'll tell you, I got that cookbook at home, and it's so cute and so delicious and so fun, and I'm really excited.
Yeah, I even love like the size of it. It's just super cute and different.
It's perfect. I love it. Okay, so Jill will be on next week. And again, if you have wheat-based questions or sustainable seafood-based questions, shoot them my way, chefemily@sharpandhot.com. I am @chefemilyp on Twitter. Olivia, are you on Twitter?
But we're on the web and on Facebook, oaec.org.
You're like, we're in the ground, man. We don't have time for Twitter.
It's true.
And you are @rebel_milk.
That's me.
That's you. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into Sharp and Hot. Until next week, keep playing with fire and knives.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.